Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, online fitness coach, nutritionist, and 3 times best-selling author. Normally here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness, and mindset. But today's episode is a solo podcast. So the first one I've done on a topic in quite a while. And for those of you who are new to the podcast, this is pretty much a press record and talk style episode where I've got 7 points in front of me and I just talk as I go along. For those of you who are longtime listeners and you enjoy this format, hopefully you will get a lot from today's episode as well. Mindset is something I've been thinking a lot about recently, partly because I'm bringing back for 2022, my Rewire Your Mindset seminar, and I've been creating new content for that. So mindset is very kind of frontline and at the very forefront of my mind at the minute. But also, one of the things that I spoke about briefly on a recent podcast with Paul Dermody, where we went nearly 2 hours in that episode, a very fly on the wall conversation, is some of the things I've been staying on top of when it comes to my mindset over the past several months. And this normally changes, but I'll explain my process as it's something that might be useful to you. When I'm trying to keep focused on the different things that are important to me, you know, I break my life into the 4 quadrants from, you know, Rewire Your Mindset, my second book, Health, Wealth, Love, and Fulfillment. And when I'm trying to stay on top of those quadrants and keep the kind of score of 10 pretty high in all of them, I have to set daily reminders to myself on what to focus on. And I normally save them in the notes on my phone, and I go back into them normally once a week, maybe twice a week if I'm struggling in particular with anything, and just remind myself of how to see a situation, how to take perspective, how to reframe certain things. If I'm struggling with anxiety, if I'm struggling with self-created deadlines, if I'm struggling with prioritizing time, if I'm struggling with energy, if I'm struggling with whatever, I'll come back to these mindset reminders and it normally shifts my focus and attention back to where it wants to be or where it needs to be, apologies. And these are the 7 I've been using for the past several months. So hopefully as we go through them, you will get things that will potentially help you in your own life, whether it's, you know, dealing with anxiety, whether it's just becoming happier in your day to day, whether it is finding what you really need to be looking at. You know, some of the, just to spoiler alert, one of the lines that I use in today's podcast is that what is what you most need is where you least want to look. It's a line from Carl Jung, and it is something that I come back to quite regularly, particularly in recent months, since I've been doing a couple of different therapies and a couple of different reflection exercises off the back of some books that I've been reading. So we'll get through and unpack all of that as we get along. But for those of you the first time listening to this style of episode, it's a press record and talk. So hopefully you enjoy and you get some stuff that you can take for your own mindset going forward. So the first one and the first daily mindset reminder is that happiness is never owned. It's only rented, and that rent is due every single day. And this is normally the story or the philosophy and approach that I'll take when I'm struggling with anxiety. For those of you who are long-term listeners of this podcast or have read any of my particularly first 2 books, I speak about my own issues with anxiety. And this is kind of the catch-22 of being a kind of type A personality, where you generally don't have a lot of issues with external success for the most part. Again, very subjective term based on what it means to you. But I don't have problems and don't struggle with getting up and go. I have a lot of natural kind of desire, a lot of natural ambition, but as a result, that comes with a downside. Again, the analogy I would use for things like ambition is like having a pet tiger, which is really cool to have, but it can also turn around and bite your face off. And if you don't control that, it can lead to this spiral of anxiety and this constant need for either external validation or worse, internal validation, where you have to prove things to yourself. And I struggle with that. And it's something that comes up in different waves. And I think, and I'm touching on this, I'm researching my new book at the minute, which will be a book on mental toughness, on anxiety, some of those misconceptions. I'll be speaking about this in the 2022 upcoming seminars about misconceptions around mental toughness, that a lot of mental toughness and that grit and discipline approach can get you to a certain point, but for a large part, it breaks down. Whereas if you can learn to manage your anxiety and you can learn to let things go and you can reframe situations, that tends to make you a lot mentally tougher than just gritting and discipline, which effectively in using willpower will run out at some point. And I have to remind myself that happiness is something that I don't own. It's something that you rent. And I think some of us are better with this than others. Paul Dermody, who I mentioned earlier, who's been on the podcast, recently and several times, doesn't struggle with this. And we talked about on that episode that he's very naturally grateful, very naturally happy, very naturally just able to see the bright side of every situation, where that's not my natural default. I have to work a lot on that. I have to do a lot of gratitude journaling, and I have to shift my focus and reframe situations and do that mental gymnastics so that I don't get overwhelmed when something bad happens. And it takes a lot of work. And that's when I tell people who struggle with it that, look, you can work on this and you can improve on this. I'm living proof of it, anecdote of one here. But a lot of people who have been in similar positions are the same. And my anxiety was very high over the month of January in particular. The book, new book came out, The Keen Edge, Mastering the Mindset for Real Lasting Fat Loss. And I had lots of peaks of anxiety, and I'm still working through where some of it came from. But it was down to the internal validation that I had of trying to top my last two books. And that anxiety, that self-imposed pressure, I created completely on myself. And it's so funny, and I'll talk about this in point four, about don't ask a fish who discovered water, i.e. if you're too close to a situation, you can't see it for what it really is, that most of these things we put on ourselves. And I work with clients day to day in my BKF online program and in other programs who have these self-imposed goals or self-imposed mental health issues, if you're talking about self-imposed and environmental depression and anxiety on two sides of a spectrum, obviously not going into mental illness or extreme mental health where people's, you know, lives are at risk. That day-to-day anxiety is normally self-imposed. You've decided that I'm going to live this way. And I'll talk in the next point about, you know, don't wish to have more, wish to desire less. That when you get clear that you need to do something every day that's going to stay on top of your happiness level, that's going to stay on top of your fulfillment level, and you can have these goals of losing weight or feeling happier and more fulfilled in your relationships or liking your job, but you also have to make sure that that failure is feedback. If you're consistently moving through and not getting closer to where you want to be, and you're also not happy on the day-to-day journey, there's a breakdown and your system and approach is a little bit broken, as somebody who's done it myself. So what I normally tell people is a combination of getting very clear on what it is you want to do, what your end goal is, i.e. get your ladder up against the right wall, if you're taking the analogy from my books, but also focusing on WIN, you know, the acronym WIN, what's important now, what can you do today that's going to help you with that end goal, and then checking in with your process. Am I enjoying this day today? There's a quote that's normally attributed to Buddha that how can you expect to be happy at a destination when you weren't happy on the journey, to paraphrase it. And I think goal setting and what you're looking to do is important to check in with regularly to make sure that this day-to-day actions that you're taking are helping you with that. The people that you're spending time with, the relationships that you're in, the job that you're doing, the diet program or training program that you're following, are these things that are in alignment with your goal, and are you enjoying them day-to-day? Because happiness isn't this thing in the future. And I had this misconception, I think for most of my 20s, probably until the age of 28, 29, that I always thought that when I did something, the analogy I use in the book or the quote is that the I'll be happy when fallacy. I'll be happy when I become a professional fitness model. I'll be happy when my business hits six figures. I'll be happy when I have a romantic relationship. I'll be happy when I get X, Y, or Z. And that thinking led to this anxiety state of constantly working towards this thing and never being present in the moment. And I think it's important that you establish what it is in your life that makes you happy. And I talk about this in the first book, The Fitness Mindset, and I'm expanding on this a little bit in the research for the new book, is we overcomplicate it, particularly things like happiness and fulfillment. And again, I'm not a happiness guru, far from it, but sometimes it's a via negativa approach, i.e. the art of subtraction that leads you to feeling happier and more fulfilled, not the addition of things. And if you make a list of all the things that make you miserable, that you hate doing, people you don't like being around, and you consciously try and do less of that every day, you're going to feel significantly happier. And then conversely, if you flip it on the other side, make a list of your happiness list. I call them my misery list, my happiness list. So all the people, all the things, the day-to-day tasks that I do that make me feel happy. Just to give you an example, some of mine are my family, spending quality time with my partner, being able to work out regularly, sleeping well, eating well, looking after my gut health, something I've struggled with for large portions of my life. All of these things make me feel really good. Same as recording podcasts, writing books. Whereas if I look on my misery list, being around toxic or negative people, or what I call emotional vampires, people who drain and suck your energy, that makes me feel really low, and that affects my day-to-day subjective happiness level. So I try and spend less time with those people. I also don't like doing things in my business that I wouldn't do for free. I'm aware not everybody can do this. I'm at a point in my life, so I'll use myself as context, that I generally don't do things in my business that I wouldn't do for free, i.e. the podcast, writing books, the courses, working with people in programs, things I absolutely love doing that fall into my desire zone versus my drudgery zone. And that makes me feel really fulfilled. And I love what I do as a result of it. And that keeps that jumping out of bed feeling every morning. Now, as I said, not everybody will do that. I didn't have that when I worked full-time as a teacher. I used to drag myself out of bed with several alarms and just pull myself into a classroom every morning. And every Friday, I knew it was the weekend. And every Monday, I knew I was going back to work. Or every Sunday, I knew I was going back to work on Monday. But once I started to shift and get that ladder up against the right wall, for me, it was a personal training career and working one-to-one in the gym to start with until it transitioned to what it is now. I got a lot of energy from that, and it made me feel a lot better. So what I'd say here is understand happiness is never owned. It's only rented, and the rent is due every single day. So it's important that you do things every day that add to that happiness list, and you, that you take the art of subtraction on the other side. Start removing things or removing people or removing situations or environments that really don't lead to you feeling the best version of yourself. So keeping that in mind, that's something I've been coming back to regularly over the last couple of months, particularly since January, and is one that I wanted to touch off and use as the catalyst for this podcast. The next point is a quote from Naval Ravikant, who says, if you're not happy with a coffee, you won't be happy with a boat or a yacht. And I love this quote, partly because it reminds me that the things that you think make you feel happy, satisfied, and fulfilled aren't always necessarily the things that on the face value will do that. And you can also translate it into taking simple pleasures and maximizing them in your own life. The old adage is that the best things in your life are free, which can be true to an extent. But for me, it draws up what I call the mindset paradox, where sometimes we think that, or we can, I have in the past anyways, I won't put words into anyone else's mouth, confused happiness and pleasure. And they're two completely different things. Happiness is a feeling and nearly a state, similar to feeling motivated. And it's normally a cumulative effect of several things and choices that you've made to feel a certain way. Pleasure is just something that gives you that high. And I've thought about this a lot in the last 6 or 12 months. And I think endurance athletes and bodybuilders and bikini athletes and extreme CrossFitters, people who really challenge themselves physically, understand this instinctively, but not always rationally. Because I always somewhat understood it from an instinctive standpoint, but I could never logically or rationally explain it until recently. When you challenge yourself to difficult things, yes, it can hurt, and yes, it can be a struggle, and it's not easy. Anyone that runs a 100-mile ultramarathon or even a marathon for a large extent will not say, well, that was super easy. It's hard. It's fucking difficult. But the feeling and the confidence and the growth that comes from the back of it, post-traumatic growth, I think is the psychological term, is normally much more long-term beneficial than the pleasure you get from skipping a training session or not hitting that goal. And I've always translated Naval Ravikant's, if you're not happy with a coffee, you won't be happy with a boat, to that, that you need to establish what it is that makes you feel happy and what it is that makes you feel fulfilled. As of now, for me, and I'll use myself as context, you're always your own best example, but feel free to dive into your own thoughts and thinking on what it is that makes you feel fulfilled. the two that have came up for me time and time again, outside of some of the obvious ones, quality time with my daughter, quality time with my partner, being around my family, being around people that I love, doing things that I enjoy, is working towards a race or event and writing books. And the reason I want to use myself as an example here is when I journaled on this, and I do a lot of journaling just to get, this is one of my biggest tools for anxiety, just getting all the thoughts out of my head. Sometimes it just feels like there's too many things fucking rushing through there, and getting it out of my head works as a form of mental catharsis that makes me feel considerably better. Something I recommend to a lot of people who struggle with the same thing. And one of the things that came up for me was not doing a race. It was training for a race. And it reminded me of a line from Gary Vaynerchuk, who has a huge social media presence. I've read several of his books, but his podcast, The Gary V Audio Experience, talks about where he's a multimillionaire, but his goal is to buy the New York Jets NFL football team. And he speaks about his goal isn't necessarily to buy the New York Jets. It's the goal of trying to buy the New York Jets. And that's how I feel about training for races. I sometimes get a huge fulfillment, satisfaction off the back of certain events, particularly things like Marathon Asab, the 6 back-to-back marathons in the Sahara that I ran in 2018. I've done a podcast on that. And the same with the Arctic in 2019, running 230 kilometers to the Arctic, 86 of which were on a torn Achilles. Again, I've covered that in a podcast as well. And I did get huge fulfillment off the back of those, huge confidence off the back of Marathon Asab, a complete rewiring with pain and how temporary pain is and how you need to push through it when it came to the Arctic. But I ran a 100-miler, my first 100-mile ultramarathon in February 2020, right before the COVID lockdown. And I didn't get that much from it. I enjoyed the race and, well, enjoyed, I use that term very loosely. I finished the race and I enjoyed having finished it. But I didn't get that much post-traumatic growth, or I didn't get any new perspective off the back of that. And it got me thinking that the races that I do don't always lead to that. It's the process of having something to train for makes me feel good. And that sounds a little bit counterintuitive. And if you're someone who's an endurance athlete or somebody who loves the stage at a bodybuilding show or a bikini show, or, you know, loves performing in a championship game or whatever it is, it might not resonate and connect. But for me, the fulfillment and the happiness comes with the challenge of training first, not necessarily the event itself. Contrarily though, writing books works in the reverse. I really struggle with book writing. I spoke about this in The Keen Edge when I was talking about the 0-1 principle. I used it in the context of the hardest part of starting a new diet or nutritional plan is the start of it. It's going from 0-1. But I used the comparison point of me writing, that writing is something that I love to do, but I struggle with. And I love having written, but I don't love the process of writing. It's one of those things that you're trading off temporary, what would be seen as an opportunity cost of doing something else you'd prefer to do for the end product of a book. And for me, I keep it in mind, a book is something that normally will long outlive me. It'll be around, and when it's done, it's done, it's complete. I can move on to the next project. It allows me to get a lot of my thoughts down onto paper. The Keen Edge, my last book, Mastering the Mindset for Real Lasting Fat Loss, was literally everything in my head that has to do with nutrition, training, sleep, stress for body compositional change, weight loss, fat loss, etc. I won't write another fitness book. I have no plans to write another fitness book. I have everything that I wanted to say in there. It's literally my magnum opus of fitness and nutrition. And having written that, I'm glad I did. But it's interesting when you ask the question, and I've spoken on previous podcasts about the power of the questions you ask yourself, and you can come back to the same question over and over again and get a different answer. That's why I think the question, it's so profound and so simple and can sound so trite, is, you know, what makes you happy, what makes you miserable? Because those two answers will change if you ask it every year, every 2 years, every 5 years, because your life will be at a different point. The old Marcus Aurelius quote, the Stoic philosopher, that the same man or woman never steps into the same river twice, because you have new experiences, new thoughts, it impacts you as a person, and the river is constantly flowing. So it's a different part of the river, a different part of the water that you're going through. And I think that's why things like books impact us so much. I will regularly reread my favorite books because my life will be in a different position. I had one of the guys, Joey, message me on Instagram when I put up the Rewire Your Mindset seminar. If you're listening to this in March, the next one is in April. If you're listening to this after April 2022, you can stay tuned on the website for any upcoming events. But Joey messaged me because he had gone to the event twice and he was contemplating coming a third time, because he said that, look, my life was in a different place every time I attend the seminar, so I get something different. Now, I've since changed it. He came to two back-to-back seminars that were nearly identical. Obviously, with the two-year break, I've added in new content, and it's a new seminar and a new event at this point. But it's interesting. That's how I always look at books. And I go back and I reread Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. I reread Seneca's Letters from a Stoic. I reread Charlie Munger's Poor Charlie Almanac. I reread Mindset by Carol Dweck. I reread Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, because you end up getting different messages each time because your life has moved forward in a different way. And to tie it back together, there's a line that I have everywhere that I spend most of my time. It's in my office, it's in my home living room, and it's in my bedroom. That's a Seneca quote. Don't wish to have more, wish to desire less. And this is something that I've had to, and have got better with, but I just need that daily reminder. As somebody who has a tendency and a propensity to escape and numb out more than you would probably think from engaging with some of my content online, whereas if I don't want to do something, I can distract and procrastinate like with the best of them. And some of my tendencies for dealing with that anxiety that comes up was falling into that consumerist materialism of buying something, getting the dopamine hit, and that would temporarily relieve me of that anxiety. Once I started to understand how dopamine triggers, there's a very good book by Dr. Anne Limbeck, L-E-M-B-K-E, I think it's called, Dopamine Nation. When I started to understand the impact of dopamine with things like buying stuff online, when it came to Instagram notifications or of social media notifications, even things in the extreme like porn, that dopamine addiction can pull you into a spiral and constantly has this craving. She talks about having, if you think and picture a weighing scale, she talks about the dopamine gremlins, that when you're going through your newsfeed or you're scrolling or watching porn or you're buying stuff online consistently over and over again with the one-click payment, it's giving those gremlins more gremlins to that dopamine side. And as a result, you find that it's really hard to get back to baseline. That's the reason for, or one of the reasons for, my digital detox at the weekends, where I'll regularly remove my phone and not go on social media, not check anything on my phone for the entire weekend. It's trying to reset that dopamine to baseline. It also means that when I am on it, I'm productive and using it, and I'm not mindlessly scrolling. The analogy I would give there is it's kind of like training. Like, you can train 7 days a week, but if you do that intensely for several months, you're going to break down and you will run into overtraining. And I think digital detox and removing yourself from your phone and social media, etc., can be a useful tool for resetting that. So again, a long way or a roundabout way of talking about desire. You know, if you're not happy with a coffee, you won't be happy with a boat. Some of my thoughts on that, and don't wish to have more, wish to desire less. As I said, it was something that I put up everywhere visually where I could see it when I was struggling with that. It also brought more awareness to the fact that I'm numbing out now, I'm escaping now because there's something I don't want to deal with, or worse, or less invasive, just a procrastination because there's a work task or something that I'm trying to avoid. So that helps me to stay on point. It allows me to control the controllables to some degree by bringing awareness to my thoughts. It also allows me to prioritize and do the things that I'm supposed to do regardless of how I feel. A quote I've regularly used on this podcast, that successful people do what they have to do regardless of how they feel, is a mantra and an approach and a mindset tattoo or brain tattoo that can be a useful adoption when it comes to getting more things done that are truly important. So that's point two. Don't wish to have more, wish to desire less. And if you're not happy with a coffee, you won't be happy with a boat or a yacht. Now on to point three. That what you most need is where you least want to look. And I spoke about this at the top of the podcast. It's a line from Carl Jung. I think it's from Modern Search for Man. It's one of the Carl Jung books that I read, and the philosopher or the psychologist Carl Jung. And this is probably the hardest one of the entire list of 7 daily reminders. And the reason is, and I'm not sure if everybody else does this, but I definitely do, that when there's something that you're really struggling with, you'll normally do everything to avoid dealing with that particular topic. And the one that comes to mind was back when I was competing in bodybuilding shows, and when I was traveling around the world as a fitness model. Just to a brief synopsis for anyone that's new to the podcast, I was a professional fitness model. I was a competitive bodybuilder for 2014, 2015. That was effectively what I did for those 2 years. And I had a real issue with my security levels in terms of my self-esteem, my confidence, and a very mild form of body dysmorphia when it comes to, I had so much value attached to the way that I looked. And on reflection, and there's a huge hindsight bias here because I couldn't see this when I was going through it at the time, but on reflection, my value, how I felt about myself, my self-esteem, my self-worth was completely external. Meaning that if I was lean and I felt muscular and I felt like I looked good, I felt good. And that would work on the flip side. If I had gone off diet or gone off plan for a week or two, or worse, post-show or post-shoot, when I would rebound crazily with my weight and my body fat and I would look like the Michelin man walking around all bloated, I would feel horrible. I would literally hide myself in my house. I would try and go to the gym at times when there was no one there so they couldn't see me, and I would wear big baggy clothes so that people wouldn't be like, well, that's the really lean guy on Instagram, and they'd see me and I look like the Michelin man from an advert. And I had such an issue with my security levels on how I looked that I never thought about asking the question, where is this self-worth issue coming from? And I told a story in my second book, Rewire Your Mindset, about, you know, when somebody commented on my legs when I was preparing for, I think it was the Worlds in Las Vegas in 2015. And it was about 7 weeks before the show, and one of the guys in the gym came in, and I was posing in the mirror, practicing my poses for the show. And he was like, man, your legs used to be a lot bigger. And I did what I normally do. You go into full on defense mode. I looked at him and kind of frowned. And then as soon as he left, I was like, fuck him. What does he know? He doesn't do a show. Fuck that guy. And then I spent the next 40 minutes looking in the mirror going, oh my God, he's right. My legs are smaller. They used to be bigger. What am I doing? I'm going to be showing up at a show. I'm going to land over in Vegas and be laughed off stage. What's going on? And it wasn't until I stopped competing, when I thought about that experience, because it obviously stuck out in my mind for a reason, that I didn't have an issue with my legs. I didn't have an issue with the words that were coming in. I had a self-worth issue. It's what I call a purple polar bear, that if somebody says to you, you know, you're fat, you're skinny, you're stupid, and that triggers within you, it's a purple polar bear, meaning that if somebody came up to you off the street and said, you know, Mark, Shauna, you're a purple polar bear, you'd be like, all right, cool, fair enough. And you wouldn't think about it that much more. But if somebody called you fat, ugly, stupid, a trigger word for you, it sticks with you for the day, potentially even longer. And that's coming up within you. That's been triggered within you. And to come full circle on that, if somebody comes into the gym to me now and says, geez, your legs used to be bigger, or your legs used to be smaller, or they used to be X, Y, or Z, it rolls off my back like a proper polar bear comment, partly because my self-worth isn't tied to the way that I look anymore. Also, my goals don't lend to body composition at the minute. I do a lot of endurance stuff. I do a lot of strength training and a lot of stuff that I enjoy doing. I train largely for my head now versus for any physical appearance. That's a kind of a side benefit of it. But those comments don't land. And I wasn't able to get to that to the root of that until I followed that Carl Jungian philosophy of that what you most need is where you least want to look. And it's hard to admit to yourself, I am really insecure. It's hard to admit to yourself that my self-esteem and self-confidence is so low, particularly for me at the time, because I was projecting outward confidence on social media, and there was a big disconnect between what I was projecting online and how I was feeling internally. And that pulled me even further, that dichotomy of, or that paradox of what I was putting out versus how I was actually feeling, made me really question who I was and my authentic self and true self. And I think it's important, regardless of what it is you're struggling with, and therapy has taught me this. I've been going to a therapist recently just to get some clarity on some thoughts and some things that I've gone through. And opening up, talking to somebody, whether it's a therapist or a close companion or a friend, or even just journaling it yourself. And a tool I gave in a recent podcast was, you know, if you're afraid of those thoughts that come up, you can always burn it. You can write it, get it out of your head, and then burn it if you don't want anybody to see something that I've done in the past, which can be quite useful. But it's going to show up in different forms. If you're insecure, or you have a self-worth issue, or a confidence issue, or a self-esteem issue, and you don't handle it, it's just going to move on to the next thing. In my area with fitness and health and wellness, I normally see it in the form of, you know, body composition or mild body dysmorphia with people. And that's, again, a very wide spectrum, all the way up to eating disorders, down to looking into a mirror every time you pass it and pulling up your shirt to see if you've got abs today. That's a very wide spectrum, but it is worth asking the question, what is it that I'm struggling with? What am I avoiding? Where is it that I really need to look? What is it that I really need to do that's going to help me shine a light on this? And who are you willing to give up in order to become another version of yourself? And I think that's important. Like, I had to let go of a lot of things when I struggled with that, issues with my body and my issues with my self-worth. I had to let go of a lot of things. I had to be willing to let my body fat climb to a certain level. I had to be willing to realize that it's not healthy or practical or potentially possible to walk around at 6% body fat for the entire year at a certain level and have a certain level of muscle mass. I had to let go of all that, and that was hard. But once I realized that it wasn't serving me, and my thinking around it was actually making me feel really unhappy, it was a little bit easier to do. And how you do it then is, you know, as I said, talking with people, reading the books, listening to podcasts, then diving in, doing the journaling, doing the reflection, whatever it is you need to do. But just remember that in a lot of cases, from my experience anyway, this one might be a bit more abstract than the others, that what you most need is normally where you least want to look. So the daily reminder 4 is one that I haven't had to check in with that often recently, but is one that I had to do quite a lot a couple of years ago. So it's just one that stays top of mind, and that's, don't ask a fish who discovered water, i.e. if you're too close to a situation, you can't see it for what it really is. And I got this philosophy from a very short and very thought-provoking book by David Foster Wallace. It's called This Is Water. And just to give you a very short synopsis of my takeaway from that, it is that, you know, fish in water don't know that they're in water. And I thought about a lot of stories and times in my life when I was going through a struggle, bad relationship, bad job, toxic people around me, friends, etc., some family members to a degree, that when you're so attached to it, you generally don't see it for what it is, because it becomes your new normal, or worse, you end up reliving what's comfortable to you or what's familiar. And something therapy taught me, my therapist said this, I think is a very profound idea, that we tend to relive the traumas because they're familiar, regardless of whether they're supportive or not. And the example he gave is, you know, if you grew up in an abusive household, emotionally was the example he gave, that your parents were always shouting at each other, and there was a lot of cortisol, a lot of adrenaline of just listening to that, that it's familiar when you're an adult that you're going to seek out something that you're, that becomes somewhat comfortable to you, if not supportive. And I remember when I was in a relationship in my 20s, and it was a toxic relationship. It was so bad for both of us. And in hindsight and on reflection, it was so obvious that we shouldn't have been together. But for whatever reason, we were both initially drawn to one another, but we fought and we argued and we would periods of weeks without speaking to one another, and we still both stayed in the relationship. And neither of us at the time could see it. And it wasn't that I was a bad person or she was a bad person. There was none of that. It was just a complete personality clash, where a square peg trying to fit into a round hole, and just this clash every time you try to put it together. And I never saw it at the time. And I had friends, unfortunately, I would wish to say that my friends told me and I listened, because I did have a good network of people around me who were like, look, you shouldn't be in this relationship and she shouldn't be with you. You're really bad for one another. And I didn't listen. I didn't listen at the time. Now, the failure is feedback. It's one of those red flags and yellow flags that for the next 10 years, I was able to see. For the next 8 years, I was able to see. And you end up being able to nip them in the bud. Even with my current partner, who is incredible, like the person I want to spend the rest of my life with, I can see when small problems come up and things that were familiar from before. And the philosophy of, you know, if you don't deal with a problem when it's small enough to be solved, you deserve to deal with the fuck up when it grows. You're able to see some of those warning signs early and deal with them before they become, you know, mountains into molehills. And I think we all have versions of that in relationships, in jobs, with our friends and environment. I remember when I was competing in bodybuilding, I had some toxic friends, like people who just thought the world was against them, that everything was, or the entire people and environment were conspiring to get them. And I think back now, and it was so obvious that those people were not good people to be around for me. It's very subjective for me, because I was trying to move past. I was trying to get to another level. I was trying to see the positive in situations. I was trying to use obstacles as stepping stones. And when you have friends who would pull you back, or you had people who would question you for trying to reach those goals, it's very easy to get sucked into that. It comes back to that 0-1 principle. I talk about protecting your environment a lot, that it's important that you protect your environment physically, emotionally, mentally, online, offline. You have to protect that environment. And if you're trying to hit a new goal, the hardest part is always the beginning, like 0-1, new diet, new training, new relationship, new job, because you don't have a lot of confidence at that point. And confidence comes from repeatedly keeping promises to yourself mixed in with having more competence with what it is you're doing. And when you're starting something new, going from 0-1, you don't have a lot of confidence because you don't have a lot of competence. You haven't been doing it long. So it's very easy for people to knock you at that point. The analogy I use is it's like legs on a table, that you don't have a lot of legs on your confidence table when you're starting a new journey. But as you hit milestones, as you go along, you know, you consistently hit the same nutritional plan and diet for a month. You consistently go to the gym 3-5 times a week because you said you would. You consistently hit, you know, your 1K, 5K, 10K milestones when you're training for a half marathon. You build up confidence that way with those small tangible goals that you're working towards. But at the beginning, it's very easy for people to swipe you at that and take those legs from underneath you. And you have to protect your environment with that, whether that's friends, whether that's family members, whether that's work colleagues. You have to protect that. And I think when you start to grasp the reality that you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with, it shines a light on who it is that's potentially supporting you and who isn't. And your inner circle and the people you spend time with don't necessarily have to get what you do, or they don't have to get the thing you do, but they just have to get that you do it. I always use my mom and sister as an example here. I remember my mom and my sister went to my first ever bodybuilding show, the Miami Pro competition in 2014. And they hadn't a clue what was going on. Like, they hadn't a clue, but they were both there in the crowd supporting me. And again, I know everybody doesn't have that with their inner circle or their family members, but there's probably people in your life who do that. They champion what you do. They might not be blood relations, but I don't believe family come always in blood relations. I think you can have family with people outside of blood. But it's important that you're doing the same for them and they're doing the same for you. But when you're in the middle of a situation, you generally don't see it for what it is. That's why I think podcasts and books in particular can be so illuminating, because they point out things and make you see your life from a different perspective based on potentially somebody who's already been through it from another side. And that's why I have to remind myself of, don't ask a fish who discovered water. If you're too close to a situation, you can't see it for what it really is. So you want to take a little bit of a wide angle view, a wide angle perspective, look at it for what it truly is. Your job, your relationship, the people you're spending time with, all of these things are important. I even remember when I was teaching, and I hated my first teaching job. I've spoken about this on previous podcasts. I fucking hated it. And I went in, it was the only time when, and I stayed as a teacher for 2 years after, but my very first teaching job, I didn't enjoy a second of it. I was working, I was the first in every evening, or the first in every morning, I was the last out every evening, and I felt like I was chasing my tail the whole time. And that came down to several things. I wasn't familiar with the English educational system. I didn't ask for help, which again was probably my own ego trying to protect myself, that I can do this, I can do it, and falling into that self-fulfilling story that just leads you down a rabbit hole that you can't get out of. And I hated it. As a result, I was miserable, where I just didn't enjoy what I was doing. And my ladder was so far against the wrong wall. It was head spinning at the time. But I still, had I not had the perspective of or conversation of speaking with my mum that Christmas, who asked what would I do for free, which completely flipped the way I saw the situation, that this isn't what I would do for free. I wouldn't work in this job for free, no chance. If I won the lottery, I would quit this job in the morning. I wouldn't be a teacher, I would go do something else. And that opened up my thinking, opened up my mind to possibilities of what I could do. But I was so close to the situation, I didn't see it. I thought I was stuck. And I'll talk about the sunk cost fallacy later. That ability or that philosophy of, because I've invested time, energy, and money, I need to keep doing it. And that's a very broken philosophy. It goes contrary to the ladder against the right wall, which I'll discuss later. But for now, if you're in the middle of something and you're not feeling happy, you have a feedback that something probably needs to change. So whether that's talking with people, going to a therapist, having a good network of friends, some people you don't need to have. I've got some incredible friends that I can have these conversations with as well. Whether that's journaling yourself, whether that's listening to a podcast or a book to illuminate or highlight what it is you need to do. If you're too close to a situation, it's probably not going to be you that gets out of it in the beginning, because you can't see it for what it really is. So you might need somebody else or something else to shift your thinking, reframe the situation slightly, and then you can take action steps, i.e. getting your ladder up against the right wall. So don't ask a fish who discovered water. If you're too close to a situation, it's too hard to see it for what it really is. So point five is, it's not about what happens to you, it's about how you react that counts. I think this crosses several different boundaries and different paradigms and ways of thinking, because I've found benefit personally, and as I said, I can only speak for myself because you're your own best example, that you can't, from my experience anyway and from my life, control probably 99% of the things that happen to you. But what you can control is how you choose to see it. You can control what frame you put on the situation. And you can control whether you label something that's happened as good or bad. And there's an old philosophy in Stoic thinking that, you know, nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And that's effectively what reacting to different situations is. And that's why I think the failure is feedback, and failure not being an end product in and of itself is such a powerful way of thinking, because it's so easy from, and I've done this, to label failure as an end product. That relationship was a failure. That job or business venture was a failure. That diet was a failure. That training program was a failure. Instead of reframing it as, that's feedback on what didn't work, and it gives me new information and data to potentially make a better decision going forward with the thing that is that I want. Diets are a great example of this. I use this in The Keen Edge, that every failed diet, every failed relationship as well, is feedback on what doesn't work. And as long as you're not making the same mistake over and over again, which in and of itself is feedback as to why are you making the same mistake over and over again. The definition of insanity is literally doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. You have feedback there in and of itself. And if you see every perceived failure as a stepping stone to the thing that you want, it's a completely new way of getting what you need, even if you didn't get what you want. And it can be a bit of a woo-woo thought. And I've had Gabby Bernstein on the podcast, best-selling author of Super Attractor, The Universe Has Your Back. And I love her philosophy on The Universe Has Your Back, that you won't always necessarily get what you want, but you'll always get what you need. And I can't speak as somebody that isn't super religious, somewhat spiritual, will think on the wider picture, but has also made a conscious choice to choose to see the world that way, that, you know, the universe will give you everything you need, you know, and not what's meant for you won't pass you. I don't have any proof of that. I don't have any data of that. I have hindsight bias, and I can narrate and a narrative fallacy, and everything that I have now, I can go back to the beginning and be like, well, I have this because of that. But the truth is, I'm just choosing to believe that because it serves me, that what's meant for me won't pass me. Whether it's work relationships, whether it's work slash relationships, whether it's business goals, whether it's races, whether it's fulfillment things I've set for myself, the things that I need will normally come into my periphery at some point, and I'll choose to be in a position to accept them when they come. It's the old adage of look is opportunity meeting the prepared mind. And how you react is more important than what happens to you. Michael Anthony was on the podcast in which we spoke about trauma and healing trauma, one of the most difficult podcasts I recorded last year by a stretch, but a very, probably one of the most beneficial ones to me personally, that you can't decide or choose to have bad things happen to you. Most of us wouldn't if we could, but you can choose to how you react to it. And when I went to the Arctic in 2019, it was a real eye-opening experience for me because I tore my Achilles 86 kilometers from the end, and I had planned, I had prepped, I had used failure as feedback. You know, I did a race in Barcelona that November, several months before the Arctic, that I completely fucked up on and had to use that failure as feedback to get through the Arctic. But then 86 kilometers from the end, my Achilles tore, the Achilles on the back of my heel. And it was the reaction that was important, not the thing that happened. And my reaction, as somebody who is a self-proclaimed bottler and normally can't have a plan B because I do give myself an out, I have enough self-awareness to realize that I can't have a plan B because I will not do something and I will quit if given the opportunity. My reaction in the Arctic was, this pain is temporary and it will go away. And it was the most pain that I've ever experienced in my entire life. Like, it felt, every step with a torn Achilles feels like somebody is shooting you with a cattle prod through your spine. It fucking hurts. And every step felt like that. But I kept repeating the mantra that pain is temporary. This will go away. I will get through this and there'll be a time when I don't have this pain. And when I came back from the Arctic, now it took me 6 months. It put me out of training for 6 months for the most part, because of the healing time from that injury. But I came back with a completely different relationship with pain, that I probably can handle a lot more than I give myself credit for. And I think we're all like this, and I think we're all somewhat victims of it and somewhat benefactors of it, that when we go through a difficult time and we come through it, that difficult time, if we think about it before it happened, we don't think we can handle it. I get such fucking inspiration when I see people who have had a loved one die, you know, particularly a child or a parent, somebody they're really close with. Like, when I see somebody pushing through that and being there for the people around them, that inspires and motivates the fuck out of me like nothing else. Because that, to me, is something that I think has potential to break you. And when you see people come out of it and come through it, for whatever their process is, a belief in God, a spiritual belief, a bigger reason for being, that, you know, I need to be here now for the other loved ones around me, being the strongest person at your father or mother's funeral, as Jordan Peterson says, I think that's so inspiring. And I take inspiration from that as somebody that has thankfully not had those experiences yet. People react in a certain way, and you can't control. And I think making peace with your own mortality, making peace with the fact that you are not going to live forever, is an awakening and a call that can knock you out of a zombie-like daywalking or sleepwalking. And it's something that I speak about at seminars. It's something I speak about at events. I speak about it in books as well, to a degree, because it's probably one of the most freeing things ever, that you're getting one life, and it's important that you make the most of it. And it's an old cliche, and it's a little bit of a trite explanation, because we all know this. Whether we choose to check in and connect with it is another thing. But what we do and everything that leads us up to that point, we don't have control of most of it, but we have control with how we react. And for me, it started with asking, well, how do I want to react when these bad situations happen? I've done the thought experiment of having loved ones die, and I've stuck with the visualization process of, I always wanted to be the oak tree in the storm, that when shit hits the fan, I want to make sure that I'm able to stand up and be around the people and be there for the people who need me the most, in whatever that looks like. And I did a similar version before I went to the Arctic. If shit hit the fan, and I didn't know what that would look like, whether it was going to be a blizzard, which happened, whether it was going to be a torn Achilles which happened, or whether it was going to be something else entirely, I said that I was going to finish and I wasn't going to tap out unless I had to be pulled out of there in a helicopter, in a rescue copter. And that sounds foreign to a lot of people and would have sounded foreign to me 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. But I didn't want to be a person that tapped out. I did that several months before at an ultra marathon in Barcelona, which wasn't even the race I was training for. It was a training race in preparation for the Arctic. And I felt so crap about myself. I took a huge confidence hit off the back of running a 76 kilometer race in Barcelona, going the wrong way, and then just completely throwing my toys out of the pram and be like, fuck this race, it's shit, directions are crap, I'm not doing it, and went back to my hotel. And then had my food, had my shower, had my mum and Holly with me, and was just sitting in the bed, fed and rested, thinking, oh my God, you just tapped out. This isn't who you want to be. This is not what you want your best version to look like. This isn't what your future self or the person you said your future self would do. And it was a reflection. It was failure as feedback. It's where that chapter in Rewire Your Mindset came from. But I think it's important for whatever it is you're going through. Pain is temporary for the most part. And life is hard. And I'm never, and if I ever do, you can fucking slap me in the face if you see me in the street, where I'm telling people, life's easy. Life's amazing. Life's fucking hard. But you choose your suffering. You choose to do the things that make you feel better. You choose to remove the things that make you feel worse. You're choosing your suffering. Like, it sucks to get up at fucking 5 or 6 a.m. But if that's what you have to do to get your workout in, then that's what you do. Like, it sucks to prepare your meals. But if you have a weight loss goal, it increases your chance of probability of success when the biscuit tin or the chocolates come out at lunch the following day. You're choosing your suffering. I think it's really important that you do that and just realize that it's not about what happens to you that matters. We can't control that for the most part, but you can control your reaction to it. So keep that in mind, that pain is temporary. Most of these things, life is, I'd say 99% of what happens to you, or 1% what happens to you, 99% how you respond to it. And keep that in your mind. This is something I come back to regularly, because for me, it's the ultimate strategy for letting go. It's the ultimate strategy for realizing that I'm choosing how I'm seeing the situation. I can choose it as a good thing. I can choose it as a lesson. I can choose it as a message, or I can choose it to let it break me in something that makes me miserable. And the choice is largely yours. And that ties me in nicely to my next point, which is there are no bad days, just character building days. And this is a complete reframe. And I'll put my hand up here and say that this is 100% I'm choosing to see situations this way. And you can take it or leave it, adopt it or not. But for me, I choose to not see bad days, just character building days. So if I've had a rough day for whatever reason, and this happens with everybody in their life, you have a fight with a loved one, you had a really hard day at work, you had a crap workout, you feel a bit sick, you feel a bit run down, whatever. You have bad days, and you can choose to see it and frame it as, well, that was a bad day, okay, reset and we go again, which is probably supportive to a degree, or you can choose it as a character building day. And that's the language. I think the language we use is important. If you're trying to build mental toughness, and as I said, there's a lot of misconceptions around mental toughness. This will be the focus of my next book, which will probably be out in 2023, 2024, of mental toughness, that you're choosing your language. You're choosing to attach words that are powerful, and they're basically ideas. And if you think of ideas, if you choose to think of the words that you speak to yourself, they're planting seeds in your mind. And I talk about Rewire Your Mindset, don't plant apple seeds and expect orange trees to grow. And you can't plant negative seeds of thought in your mind and then expect to have a positive outlook. And character building days are one of my hacks, or one of my self-talk strategies for building that mental toughness, because it makes you realize that you are a lot stronger than you think you are. And you can handle things that if it happened to somebody else, you'd be like, well, fuck, I'd hate if that happened. But when it happens to you, you're able to push through and come through it. And I think we don't give ourselves enough credit here. When people have had bad days and bad things happen, and we come out the other side of it, it doesn't break you. Like, it's life, it's amazing. It's amazing to me with some of the bad shit that people go through. People I've had in this podcast, people I've spoken to on social media, people I've spoken to offline who have had really bad things happen to them and they're still fucking standing. I'm like, that's amazing. That's inspiring. They're people who are being broken down bit by bit, but are coming back stronger. They're effectively becoming anti-fragile. Nassim Nicholas Taleb has a book titled anti-fragile, where if you think of fragile, something that breaks easily, robust is something that doesn't break easily, anti-fragile is something that gets stronger the more you challenge it. And I think if you have an anti-fragile approach and you have a character building approach, you can come out of difficult situations way fucking stronger than you were when you went in. And that's why it's important, I think, to do things that challenge you. The complete mindset paradox that, you know, doing difficult things makes your life feel easier is so true. Because when you do these things that make you feel out of your comfort zone, or push you out of your comfort zone, or make you feel like, do you know what, I don't really think I can do that, but fuck it, I'm going to try. And you do that and it goes badly, you're becoming a slightly stronger version of yourself. You're building that little bit more character. And I look back on my situation when I was preparing for the Worlds in Vegas in 2015. It was a few months after my daughter Holly was born. And I had this complete wave of overwhelm, a complete full-on anxiety attack. I talk about it in my first book, The Fitness Mindset, where I was crying into my steering wheel because I just didn't know. I was so overwhelmed. I was worried about how I'd do with the show. I thought I was worried about I was going to be a crap dad. I didn't know what was going on in other areas of my life. I was just all over the place. And at the time, my frame was, my life is shit, fuck this. As opposed to being like, this is a challenge that you're getting to be better. This is a challenge you're getting to be stronger. Buck the fuck up and deal with it. And that's the reframe that I put now when I find myself falling into kind of a pity party. And I talk about, and I'm researching this at the minute, and I've spoken about it on previous podcasts, about that contrast between tough love approach and self-compassion with yourself. And I think it's a tool. You never want to be the man with the hammer to the whole world looks like a nail, the biblical quote, that you don't want to use tough love in every situation where you're constantly beating yourself up. But you also don't want to use self-compassion in every situation. There's a time and a place for both. When you're trying your best and you're consistently getting pushed back, but you are getting one step back for two steps forward, self-compassion is probably the way to go, where you're being a bit more compassionate and going, well, actually, I'm way further ahead than I was several months ago. I think weight loss is a great example of this. Someone who's comparing themselves and jumping into comparison mode with somebody else online, offline, etc. But when they reflect on how they've done over the last 6 weeks or 6 months, they're like, actually, I'm way further ahead. Self-compassion is the tool to use in that place. But if you're being soft, you need to go to do your workout, and you don't want to do it, and you just keep pushing it off and not doing it, you need to toughen the fuck up, and you need to set your alarm, and you need to get up and do your workout. You need to get into the gym. You need to get in your work step count outside of it. You need to do something that moves you closer to your end goal. That, or you make peace with the fact that you align the expectations and you don't really want your end goal, which is totally fine as well. But if you said you're going to do something, if you said this is the thing I want, you need to do the daily action steps to help you get there. And that's about building character. That's about choosing to be more mentally tough on the days when you need it. It's choosing to put that lens on it so that you get out and you get your workout, or you prepare your meals, or you make that business call, or you do whatever the thing is you need to do that you know will move your life forward in a meaningful way, but you don't really feel like it. As I said, successful people do what they have to do regardless of how they feel. And you can condition yourself to do that. But it starts with choosing no bad days. It comes with character building days. I've been on both sides of the spectrum. I've been on the side where I felt sorry for myself. I've been on the side where I was the victim and having a little pity party for myself. And I've been out the other side when I've been too hard on myself and needed to be more self-compassionate. And I've been too self-compassionate and needed to be tougher on myself. So it's a case of finding what do you need to do right now to help you get to your end goal and whatever it is that you're looking to do. But realize there's no bad days. The workouts, the fights, the stresses, they're just character building days. And then the final point, which I think ties it all together, is have zero sunk costs. And this is something that never really leaves my mindset reminder list, because it's so easy. For anyone unfamiliar with the sunk cost fallacy, it's basically an economics and business decision-making tool. So a sunk cost is a cost that has already been incurred and cannot be recovered, meaning that you put good money after bad in the economics or business sense. But we do this in our personal lives as well with jobs, where I've done it myself, where I've spent so long when I was teaching, my 4 years doing my undergraduate degree, my postgraduate degree. And then when I went teaching, I felt like I couldn't not do it. I'm like, I've spent so much time, energy and money on this. I have to do this job now. Or in a relationship where, well, I've been going out with this person for a year, 2 years, 3 years. Like, I don't want to end it now. I've been going out with them for so long. And that sunk cost fallacy is something that holds a lot of us back. And if you don't have awareness of it, it kind of runs on automatic, which is the problem with it. And it's happened to me in several shapes and forms. I've mentioned when I was teaching, that's where it happened to me once. It's also happened to me in relationships. I'm like, well, we've been going out for a year and a half. I'm like, do I really want to start a new relationship? I'm like, well, I'll just keep going with this one, considering and continually sticking in a relationship that made me miserable. And both, that's not just me, that was on both sides. So I would ask the question here to get out of this train of thought is, what would you do right now if you didn't think about the past or the time, energy, and money you put into it? And that brings the ladder up against the right wall analogy back to the forefront. One of the reasons it's so difficult to get your ladder up against the right wall, and for me, when I was teaching and I came up with that analogy, it was when I had walked into my first teaching job, I had the feeling that I spent so long and energy, time, and money climbing a ladder, and then it was up against the wrong wall. And then when I started personal training and working in the fitness industry, I was at the very bottom, but it felt like my ladder was up against the right wall. That's what I wanted to do. And one of the reasons it's so difficult to either be at the top or halfway up a ladder is because there's a lot of effort in climbing back down and putting the ladder against another right wall. And that's where your sunk cost fallacy comes in. And everyone has different situations here. And I'd never want to be that mindset coach or life guru, labels that get given to me externally versus ones that I put out myself, that says, you know what, quit your job, go do something you love, break up with your partner, go find someone that's right for you, you know, quit your personal trainer or your diet and go do something that's sustainable. Different people have different circumstances that they can't do these things right now. And I think a job is a good example. If you're somebody who's 22, 23, 24, no ties, you know, very little debt payments, and you want to do something in a new career that you think will light you up and get you jumping out of bed every morning, you're going to be able to do that faster than someone that's in their 40s who has a mortgage and three kids. And my advice is largely the same. I would start getting your ladder against the right wall. It's just give yourself enough runway of time to make the transition. And somebody who's 24 with no life ties might be able to get up and running and go from zero to one in 3 months, 6 months, a year. Somebody with more commitments, it might take longer, might take several years. But the time is going to pass anyways. So you may as well do the thing that you want to be doing. And if you find that you're walking around living life in this sleepwalking mode, and you've resigned yourself to the fact that, you know, it is what it is, which you probably don't have that thinking if you're listening to this podcast by its very nature. You're not listening to and haven't got this far over an hour into a mindset podcast if you're willing to just settle for life and you think it is what it is. That what Carol Dweck calls in her book Mindset, that closed mindset or that fixed mindset. You probably have that growth mindset, but you just align your expectations. The advice is nearly identical when I work with somebody who has 10 pounds to lose and 100 pounds to lose, that we have to do the things consistently every day that help us lose the 10 pounds or 100 pounds. It's just going to take considerably longer in the case of the person with 100 pounds to lose, for the most part, all other things equal. You don't adjust the goals, you adjust the time frame, and you adjust the expectations around it and how long it'll take to get there. And that's where removal of sunk cost can help. And I'm not saying to quit your job. I'm not saying to break up with your partner. I'm not saying to get on a new diet or training program or whatever it is. What I am asking is if to consider, is your ladder up against the right wall right now? And if it's not, do you need to change it? And if you do decide to do that for whatever reason, because you're not happy, you're not fulfilled, it's not the thing you want to do, then what are the things you can do today that can potentially help you get there? And you might not have to take any physical action today. It might be reading a book, following up with another podcast, consuming information that gives you a little bit less fear around the topic. From my experience, most fear around change comes from a lack of data. So you can minimize a lot of that perceived fear by consuming information that gives you a little bit more of a bridge to getting from A to B or A to Z. The things that have frightened me and scared me the most, I spoke about some of them in this podcast. One was getting on stage initially as a bodybuilder, terrified the fucking shit out of me. Running marathon to Saab, going to the Sahara. I have on the website a clip from my Rewire Your Mindset seminar about the letter I wrote myself before I went to the Sahara, where I was just absolutely petrified. Same with the Arctic. I had fear around the conditions, but I was able to minimize a lot of those fears by, one, listening to inspirational people and motivating people who have either done what I want to do or have done something that where they felt the same way and they learned to feel the fear and do it anyways, mixed with giving myself more data on how it is that I do it. I learned how to, you know, load my water and cut my water for a show. I learned how to get my body fat down. I learned what I needed to survive to the Sahara. I learned and put myself in conditions with ice baths and cryotherapy that I could condition my body to deal with the cold for the Arctic, something that I was afraid of going out there as someone that lives in the west of Ireland and doesn't get exposed to those conditions regularly. You minimize that fear with the data. And a misconception around fear is that fear goes away for people. And maybe I don't have enough life experience in my 34 years on this planet, but as of now, I can tell you it doesn't go away. You just get better at dealing with it. You just get better at managing it, and you get better at feeling the fear and doing it anyways. And that's the secret to it. Like, there's all things that we're afraid of out there, whether it's, you know, afraid to do X, Y, or Z, or go after that person that we're attracted to, or talk to that person we're attracted to, or go after that job that we really want. We all have these fears. They never really go away. It's just that as you consistently attack that fear and go towards it, you get better at managing it. And then it transitions into all areas of your life. So I think it's important to, in this podcast, and finish up on talking about fear, that fear is something that will never go away. But as someone who let it, for me, had a lot of fear disguised as practicality. You know, I can't leave a safe and secure job to start my own business. You know, I shouldn't do a fitness model or bodybuilding show. That's, you know, it's not something that would be done. It'll take all my energy and I won't have time with my friends. Fear disguised as practicality. For me, you overcome that, come out the other side of it, and then you realize that, you know, my favorite acronym for fear is false evidence appearing real. And that's normally what happens with it once you establish the difference between real fear and perceived fear, where there's an actual genuine threat of something bad happening versus the perceived threat of something bad happening. I'll be embarrassed, or people will laugh at me, or what will people think? They're all perceived fears. So we'll end on that note. There's 7 daily reminders, mindset reminders to myself, the ones that I've been looking at recently about happiness: never owned, only rented, and the rent is due every single day. I think it's especially applicable for those of you similar to me who deal with that daily anxiety. If you're not happy with a coffee, you won't be happy with a boat. Don't wish to have more, wish to desire less. That what you most need is where you least want to look. One of the most probably deeper and profound mindset reminders on this list, but probably the one that yielded the most benefit for me. Don't ask a fish who discovered water, i.e. if you're too close to a situation, you can't see it for what it really is. It's not about what happens to you. It's about how you react to it that counts. And there are no bad days, just character building days. And don't let the zero sunk cost fallacy affect your life in a negative way just because you've spent time, energy, and money doing something. If your ladder's up against the wrong wall, it's up against the wrong wall. And you probably need to climb back down and get it to where it needs to be. So that's all from today's podcast. Hopefully you enjoyed it. That's 7 daily mindset reminders to myself, solo podcast. Catch you all next week.